Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Book publishers in Hong Kong are warning about censorship. Ashley Thompson is here to tell us more about that.
Bookstores are reportedly under pressure to not carry books that may offend the central government in mainland China.
In a small Central African country, elephants are increasingly coming into contact with humans because of population increases. Jim Tedder will tell us how the country is dealing with that problem.
Elephants in Uganda are starting to come close to villages near national parks. The big animals are a real danger to people.
And in her weekly environment and science report, Marcia James tells us about the debate over a new kind of rice.
It has been genetically changed or modified to produce beta carotene, a form of vitamin A.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America in Washington. We'll have those stories, along with our weekday series, The Making of a Nation. Today, we continue our story on the peace conference that followed World War I.
American President Woodrow Wilson was one of the chief negotiators at the conference in Paris. Throughout the early months of 1919, he struggled hard for a treaty that would result in peace with justice for all sides.
Finally, in our American Moments series, we take you back 35 years ago today, to April 7th, 1980. That was the day the American President Jimmy Carter announced he had cut diplomatic relations with the government that controlled Iran.
This lays bare the full responsibility of the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Revolutionary Council for the continued illegal and outrageous holding of the innocent hostages.
This is As It Is, a daily 30-minute program from VOA Learning English. Every day, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Book publishers and authors are warning that censorship is increasing in Hong Kong. They say bookstores are returning books written by authors who have been connected to or involved in the recent pro-democracy protests. Ashley Thompson tells us bookstores are reportedly under pressure to not sell books that may offend the central government in mainland China.
Carmen Kwong Win Soon is the chief editor of the book publishing company Up Publications. She said her company had hundreds of books returned by Sino-United Publishing, which oversees several other publishing companies. Ms. Kwong co-wrote a book on the Occupy Central protests. She said the book received orders for only 28 copies instead of the normal 200 copies. She also said most of the books recently returned by Sino-United Publishing were not about political topics. Sino-United Publishing operates 51 stores through its subsidiaries. Company officials say each store owner makes his or her own decision about which titles to carry. Bruce Lui Ping-kun is a former reporter and now teaches journalism at Hong Kong's Baptist University. He said The rejection of books by publishers supportive of the pro-democracy movement is part of the increased censorship in the city. I think looking at the book censorship case, in a way, it's a reflection of the differences between censorship in Hong Kong and the censorship we have under One Country, Two Systems, he said. Mr. Lui also said censoring books from publishers supportive of the pro-democracy movement is an example of, in his words, creative ways to limit or stop voices that are hostile to the Communist Party. David Bandursky is a researcher at the University of Hong Kong's China Media Project. He said censorship is becoming more widespread in Hong Kong, from print media to broadcast media. He said friends in the media industry tell him about the difficulties they face when trying to cover sensitive news. Because I have a lot of friends working in the industry who discuss with me quite a lot. Sometimes, when they want to do some kind of sensitive news, especially on mainland China, then their boss will use all kinds of excuses to block them or give them more difficulties in doing so. I'm Ashley Thompson.
You are listening to As It Is from The Voice of America. Elephants usually travel the same paths. But in Uganda, the animals are changing their migration patterns because of increases in the populations of humans and elephants. So, officials are using vuvuzelas to annoy elephants. What are vuvuzelas? Jim Tedder is here with the answer.
Elephants in Uganda are starting to come close to villages near national parks. The big animals are a real danger to people. So the Uganda Wildlife Authority has been giving people new tools to keep the elephants away. Vuvuzelas. They are plastic instruments some fans use at sports events. The instruments make a loud sound elephants do not like. The animals leave, and no one is harmed. A spokesperson for the Uganda Wildlife Authority says vuvuzelas work because they do not threaten the elephants. That is important because an elephant that feels threatened is more likely to attack. So far, no one has reported an elephant attacking in answer to a vuvuzela. Officials and villagers have tried other ways to stop elephants from coming near farms and houses. They have built beehives, houses for flying insects that sting. They have hung ropes covered in spicy oil. They have dug long, deep holes. And they have used guns called AK-47s. An official from the Uganda Wildlife Authority explains that people shoot the gun in the air to scare the elephant. But over time, the elephants have stopped being afraid of the sound of the gun. They only look at the shooter and wave their ears. Another official for the Uganda Wildlife Authority, Gesa Simblicius, says one elephant prevention solution will not work everywhere in Uganda. And one day, elephants may accept the vuvuzela noise, just as they do the sound of the AK-47. But right now, vuvuzelas are an effective, non-violent, and fun way to deal with a serious problem. I'm Jim Tedder.
It It's time now to hear from Marcia James. Every week at this time, she reports on the latest agriculture, environment, and science news. This week, she tells us that scientists in the Philippines are working to make changes to rice. They hope these changes will help solve one of the world's biggest health issues, the lack of vitamin A. But not everyone is happy about the work of these scientists.
It is called golden rice because the rice is yellow. It has been genetically changed or modified to produce beta-carotene, a form of vitamin A. Opponents of genetically modified foods, including the environmental group Greenpeace, do not like what the scientists are doing. But supporters of golden rice say it could help save as many as 2 million lives a year. Young children and pregnant women can and do die from vitamin A deficiency. Vitamin A is missing from the food of millions of people in the developing world. The deficiency is the leading cause of childhood blindness. It is a public health problem in half of all countries, including many in Africa and Southeast Asia. Patrick Moore is an ecologist and former Greenpeace president. He supports production of golden rice. He says there should not even be debate about the issue while children starve. Mr. Moore left Greenpeace in the 1980s and disagrees with many of its positions. VOA asked Greenpeace to answer Mr. Moore's criticisms of its opposition to golden rice. The group answered in an email. It read, "Genetically engineered crops consist almost entirely of herbicide-tolerant and insect-resistant crops marketed to developing countries." It said this agricultural model damages human health and hurts farmers and the environment. Large companies do produce some genetically modified crops. They gain legal control of the plant production through patents, but government and donor money is being used to develop golden rice in the Philippines. These groups hope farmers throughout the developing world will someday grow it. They hope it will help solve a problem that many scientists believe is as serious as malaria or tuberculosis. Daniel Ocampo is a Southeast Asia agriculture expert for Greenpeace in Manila. He argues that golden rice is still not ready as a food for humans after 20 years of research. He says it could be more dangerous than its supporters will admit. The International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines has been experimenting with golden rice for 9 years. It says it has more work to do before the rice can be eaten by humans. I'm Marcia James.
Thanks, Marcia. Now, time for our daily The Making of a Nation program. In 1918, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, a truce took effect between the Allies and Germany. But not until 7 months later was a treaty signed to officially end what was known as the Great War and the War to End All Wars. Today in our series, Shirley Griffith and Larry West continue the story of the peace conference following World War I.
American President Woodrow Wilson was one of the chief negotiators at the conference in Paris. Throughout the early months of 1919, he struggled hard for a treaty that would result in peace with justice for all sides. Wilson demanded a treaty that provided for a new international organization. He called it the League of Nations. To Wilson, the League was more important than any other part of the treaty. Not all Americans shared Wilson's opinion. Many feared the League would take away the power of the American government to declare war and make treaties. They also agreed with the leaders of the other Allied nations. Establishing the League was less important than punishing the defeated enemy.
The other major Allied leaders at the peace conference were Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, and Premier Vittorio Otto of Italy. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Otto understood how much Wilson wanted the League of Nations. They used this knowledge to win Wilson's approval for other parts of the peace treaty. Wilson soon learned that to get the League, he had to compromise on many issues. For example, he had to accept British and French demands to make Germany pay all war damages. The payments added up to more than $300,000 million. Wilson also had to accept the Allied takeover of Germany's colonies.
Some of Wilson's compromises violated his belief in self-determination. This was the right of all people to decide for themselves who would govern them. One compromise, for example, gave to Japan Germany's colonial rights in the Shantung area of China. China protested the decision. It asked that control of Shantung be returned to the Chinese government. But President Wilson needed Japan's support for the League of Nations, so he accepted Japan's demand for control of Shantung. There were other violations of the policy of self-determination. These affected the people and land along the borders of several European nations. For example, 3 million Germans were made citizens of the new nation of Czechoslovakia. Millions of other Germans were forced into the newly formed nation of Poland. And Italy received territory that had belonged to Austria.
Today, most history experts agree Woodrow Wilson was correct in opposing these decisions. They say Germany's loss of territory and citizens caused deep bitterness, and the bitterness helped lead to the rise of fascist dictator Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. In East Asia, Japanese control over parts of China created serious tensions. Both decisions helped plant the seeds for the bloody harvest of World War II 20 years later. But Allied leaders at the Paris Peace Conference were not looking far into the future. As one person said at the time, they divided Europe like people cutting up a tasty pie.
After months of negotiations, the peace treaty was completed. The Allies gave it to a German delegation on May 7, 1919. The head of the delegation objected immediately. He said the treaty was unfair. He urged his government not to sign it. At first, Germany did not sign. the leader of the government refused and resigned in protest. But a new government was formed, and its leader signed the document at a ceremony at the palace in Versailles outside Paris. Finally, World War I was officially over.
President Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States after the treaty signing ceremony. He was not completely satisfied with the treaty, yet he believed it was still valuable because it established the League of Nations. Wilson's battle for the League was only half over when the treaty was signed in Europe. He had to win approval from the United States Senate. That half of the battle would not be easy.
Part of the problem was political. Wilson was a member of the Democratic Party. The Senate was controlled by the Republican Party. Also, Wilson had refused to name any important Republicans to his negotiating team at the peace conference. Part of the problem was personal. A number of senators disliked Wilson. One was Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge was the powerful chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He told a friend he never expected to hate anyone as much as he hated Wilson.
Wilson spoke before the Senate just 2 days after he returned from Europe. He urged it to approve the peace treaty. Wilson said, "The united power of free nations must put a stop to aggression, and the world must be given peace. Shall we and any other free people refuse to accept this great duty? Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? We cannot turn back. America shall show the way. The light streams upon the path ahead and nowhere else."
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee began hearings on the treaty. It heard a number of people who opposed the League of Nations. They said the League would destroy the freedom and independence of the United States. The committee completed its hearings and prepared a report for the full Senate. The report said the United States should reject the treaty unless changes were made. The committee proposed almost 40 changes.
The committee's report was a blow to President Wilson, both politically and personally. He had worked extremely hard to win Europe's support for the idea of a League of Nations. Great crowds in Paris had cheered him and his idea. Now, the Senate of his own country was about to reject it. Wilson decided he must take his case out of the hands of the people's representatives. He would take the case directly to the people themselves. He would build public support for the treaty. If enough citizens supported it, he believed, the Senate could not reject it.
President Wilson planned a speaking trip all across the country. His family and his doctor urged him not to go. They said he was still weak from a recent sickness. But Wilson refused the advice. He said the treaty was more important to him than his own life. The president left Washington in early September. He traveled in a special train. In city after city, he made speeches and rode in parades. he shook thousands of hands. At times, he suffered from a painful headache. But there was no time to rest.
Everywhere Wilson stopped, he urged the people to support the League of Nations. It was, he said, the only hope for peace. In Boulder, Colorado, 10,000 people waited to hear him. By then, Wilson was extremely weak. He had to be helped up the steps of the building where he was to speak. He made the speech. He said he was working to honor the men who had died in the war. He said he was working for the children of the world.
President Wilson put all his heart and energy into his speeches. And as his family and doctor had warned, the pressure was too great. While in Wichita, Kansas, the pain in his head became terrible. He could not speak clearly. His face seemed frozen. A blood vessel had broken in his brain. Wilson had suffered a stroke. The president was forced to return to Washington. His condition got worse every day, and soon he was unable to move. Woodrow Wilson would spend the rest of his presidency as a terribly sick man. He continued to hold on to his dreams of a League of Nations, but his dreams now filled a broken body. We will continue our story tomorrow here on As It Is. Finally, it was on this day, April 7th, 1980, 35 years ago, that the United States cut diplomatic relations with the government that controlled Iran. President Jimmy Carter said the United States was acting because the Iranian government had refused to take control of American hostages from so-called militant students. In November 1979, Iranians attacked the American embassy in Tehran and took diplomats and workers hostage. President Carter said the United States would hold Iran's leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, and his government responsible for the safety of the hostages.
This lays bare the full responsibility of the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Revolutionary Council for the continued illegal and outrageous holding of the innocent hostages. The Iranian government can no longer escape full responsibility by hiding behind the militants at the embassy.
President Carter spent much of what was left of his term in office trying to negotiate a deal to free the hostages. The 52 Americans were finally released on January 20, 1981, after both sides approved a complex settlement. It happened on the day that President Carter left office and Ronald Reagan became president. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. We want to hear what interests you. Email us. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington. For all of the women and men of the Voice of America all around the world, and for all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is, from the Voice of America.